mangle, slaughter, trounce, a fearful beating, a slugging orgy. They may sound like the back of a horror movie, but these were all terms used to describe the events of a 1930 Phillies game against the Brooklyn Robins. It may have been less than a year since the stock market crash of 1929, but the greatest depression was probably the Phillies pitching, as well as the torpedoing of the American economy, the tanking of which shattered lives across the nation in a way that was, in many cases, irrecoverable and forever tainted an entire decade of this country's history. This and other uplifting stories of human triumph on this episode of The Dirty Inning. Welcome to The Dirty Inning, a podcast on which we, of course, discuss the worst, dumbest, most hilarious, or most obscure innings in Phillies history. I, of course, am explaining the nature of this podcast because, Trev, I mean, we have a wave of new listeners, if the numbers are any indication, because apparently something has happened recently that has made Phillies themed media just so much more consumable. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to the papers, but I don't know what that could be.
Me neither. I think, Jake Arrieta had a good spring opening. Maybe that's it.
That's true. I think Jake Arrieta made a solid spring debut. Three exhibition innings from the Phillies, maybe number two pitcher, is enough to see a dramatic spike in listenership for any podcast related
Definitely.
To so I
think happy Jake Arrieta Day.
Well, like I said, anybody who's new to this podcast, boy, you're in for a real treat.
You're in for a ride. I hope you're listening, hoping for news and analysis.
You poor idiot. No, this is like I said, a podcast where we really dive deep into the archives to talk about past instances of Phillies baseball that were really just atrocious or worthy of pointing and laughing at. Today, we will be going several decades back to a game that took place in 1930. But as I noted in the intro, there were a couple of choice terms used to describe this game by the papers. And, you know, you got slaughter, mangle, a fearful beating. Trev, just hearing those terms, can you think of what's the most violent language you've ever seen used to describe a baseball game?
It's going to be hard to beat mangle. Let's see. Bloodfest.
I was going to say, and this is, of course, an everyday question that you'll have an answer to off the top of your head.
Bloodfest is not really one. I guess I've seen that word before, but not in terms of video games. It's just when I have my Bloodfest invitations.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, of course. By the way, make sure your address is updated.
No problem.
Bloodfest is always coming up, such is the nature of Bloodfest. No, Bloodbath. I think Bloodbath is the most intense. How about you?
Yeah, I feel like I've seen Bloodbath before too. Yeah, like in just especially atrocious games, and I mean, you know, this game that the Phillies lost, by the way, by many runs on September 6th, 1930. They were using a lot of very violent language to describe it because I think you'll agree with this. The more wide open a game is blown, the less recognizable it is as baseball. So when it becomes less like a typical 5-3, 2.5-hour yawn fest that wraps up around 10 at night, yawn fest, of course, being the festival scheduled a week after Bloodfest. Don't get those two confused. But one of those typical games, you turn off the TV, go to bed. We start using more illustrious or cartoonish words to describe games that don't fit into that normal category. I think the threshold has to be that 20-run mark. I think you'd probably agree, right?
Oh, boy. Wow. Glad you said that.
I mean, sometimes it seems baseball just isn't built to support 20 runs by one team in a single game. I feel like you see a lot of laughers that end with one team scoring 18 or 19. And at that point, maybe the starters come out. Maybe the hustle is dialed back a bit. Maybe now is like when somebody tries to bunt for a base hit or steal a base. That's when the other team gets like riled up. You see the other manager yelling at the opposition or somebody gets hit by a pitch on purpose. Because like that's when it's like, all right, that's about as close as the highest form of baseball comes to like a mercy rule, is that the other team just knows, okay, we can stop scoring runs now. Even though at any point that other group of professional athletes could, you know, summon their talent that they supposedly have and mount a comeback of some kind, it's still just one of those professional courtesies, I guess. When a baseball game has a football score, it seems like it becomes something else. Remember, what was it, last year, maybe the year before, when the Phillies scored so many runs on Jeremy Guthrie that he quit baseball forever the next day?
No, I don't.
you don't remember? That was just like a year ago, I think. But
did he really quit baseball?
Yeah, he retired. They wow. just you know,
oh,
didn't
you
have
know
it
what?
Anymore.
I do. Yeah, what was that like? Oh my gosh, yeah, I'm remembering that now. Where like, wasn't he on the Nationals? Is that right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone was like, "Ooh, the Jeremy Guthrie could bring something to this rotation." And the Phillies beat him so badly that he's like, "Yeah, just not a major league pitcher anymore."
Oh, it was also his birthday. Don't forget, it was Jeremy Guthrie's 38th birthday when the Phillies scored 12 runs in the first inning, and it was in April 2017. So it was 2 years ago. Yeah. As CBS Sports wrote, it's very possible Saturday was the worst moment of his career.
I mean, I would say so.
So, I don't know. I mean, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, that at a certain point, when a game gets lopsided enough, it just stops being baseball. I mean, is that true? Like, is that,
yeah,
like,
I think that's true. I mean, there's something to the idea that, like, because, like, I think the corollary here is everyone talks about there needing to be, like, a mercy rule. You hear that a lot, where it's like, okay, like, this game is so out of hand, we need a mercy rule here. But I think that's what's cool about, that's what's cool about baseball in general, in that, like, you can come back from deficits like that. It's not like, you know, football, where if you're down 56 to zero in the fourth quarter, you're not gonna win the game. But I do think when it's like 23-0 or 23-1 or whatever, and you have position players pitching and stuff, it becomes more like a home run derby or an exhibition game or something. Like, it's kind of its own weird, bizarro world sport.
I mean, nobody's watching at that point. Like, even
only
if
the fans of the team who are winning are watching.
Well, even then, I was going to say, if the Phillies are up by, like, if the Phillies have scored 20 runs and clearly the game is, you know, over at that point, I'm not going to, like, I'll get distracted by something else. Like, you just, you know, it's more fun that way. But at the same time, I don't think anybody's going to fault you for finding something else to do in a baseball game that could go on for hours still, that's already gone on for hours because someone had time to score 20 runs in it. So, yeah, I just think it just turns into something else at that point. And it's not necessarily baseball at its best, I would say.
Well, yeah, baseball at its best has a sense of tension to it.
Mm-hmm.
That is not tense. Unless it's like the game, you know, 7 of the World Series. Even if you're up 20, there's jubilation and stuff, but you're also still thinking, like, could this actually go south? Could this be the worst loss of all time? Could it happen?
Imagine being the broadcaster in a Game 7 of the World Series that you have to make, but it's like a lopsided game with 20 runs being scored in like the third inning, and you got to make the rest of it like interesting. Well, we got all this. Ken Rosenthal still going out of the dugout to talk to, you know, the DH about switching from right-handed to left-handed this offseason. So I guess we got to promote the hell out of that. But God damn it, what the hell are we going to do for the next 3.5 hours with commercial breaks?
I guess if you're Joe Buck, you can just, like, stop putting on the ruse that you care about baseball and just kind of just start talking about football. Just go through the standings.
Just starts dancing with the Fox NFL robot.
Finally, the love which cannot speak its name.
Yes, folks, it has come to this.
Don't make another Joe Buck tweet unless you don't value your mentions.
Well, the Phillies allowed 20 runs to be scored against them twice in 1930. Ooh. They allowed 15 runs or more to be scored against them 17 times.
Wow. Seems like they were not a great team in 1930. Is that
I'm reading that, and I can't believe that it's like I didn't remember writing it the first time I did. Like, I started laughing because I was like, is that a typo? That can't be right. 17? That is a ton of times, it feels like.
They let them play baseball?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they let them play. They let them lose because they lost 102 times. They finished 40 games out of first place and 7 games out of second to last place, which is, to me, the way I've started measuring some of these god-awful teams we talk about on this podcast is not measuring how far they were out of first, but how far they were out of the next to last place, because that's often an even more clear indicator of how terrible and putrid a team actually is. And finishing 7 games behind the team that was in second to last is pretty bad for a team that lost 102 games. So, my God, though, this is what's hilarious about, and it's so dead ball era of this team. They had so many hitters, and they played in the Baker Bowl, which with its joke of a right field fence. They had Chuck Klein, they had Lefty O'Doul, Spud Davis, Bernie Freeberg, Don Hurst, Monk Sherlock, and Pinky Whitney. All of them, all of those guys, they all hit over 300 that year.
Household names. Pinky Whitney, we all know him.
Well, that's what I mean. You don't even necessarily need to know these guys to know that they all hit over 300. Like, that's how many hit. I dream of having a team full of that many 300 hitters right now in 2019.
This is one of those classic Phillies teams that we talked about from the dead ball era, where it's like, absolutely, the problem is that the pitching is just dreadful, right? Like, the pitching is really, really bad, right? Like, that has to be the problem.
Oh, you're getting a little ahead here, because, yeah, you've absolutely called that correctly.
I feel like we talked about another 20s or 30s team where this was the case, where it was like, man, they're full of hitters, but the problem is they are horrible at pitching.
But, I mean, you know, how many, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like 8 guys who can hit over 300. That's your entire lineup hitting over 300, and your pitching staff is so bad that you lose 102 games? That is crazy.
Chuck Klein, unbelievable.
Chuck Klein had over 40 home runs because, again, they're playing all their home games in the Baker Bowl. 7 of those guys had over 20 doubles. Klein and O'Doul had season OPSs over 1,000. I mean, and they only won 52 games.
It's extremely cool.
Yeah. I mean,
they must have just a great time. I mean, I would imagine like they were just loving life.
Yeah, the team chemistry was through the roof that year. You know, they'd go out there, score 15 runs, lose by 6 runs, and just hit the town. You know, absolutely just happy to be alive, thrilled to be together in that glorious American year of 1930, less than 1 year removed from the worst economic depression in United States history.
And don't forget, probably a lot of them knew veterans of the worst war we'd ever see.
Oh, absolutely. Or were veterans of the worst war we'd ever seen. So, the lowest ERA in this 4-man rotation of Phil Collins, Ray Benji, Les Sweetland, and Claude
Please
Willoughby.
Please tell me we're going to have a Phil Collins game.
I'd glossed right over Phil Collins' name because I knew you would have a audible reaction to it. Unfortunately, it is not going to be Collins we focus on in this game. Sweetland and Willoughby made a combined 49 starts, and they each had ERAs north of 7. The lowest ERA in the rotation was Phil Collins, who had a 4.78.
Oh man, that is that's like Rockies in the early 2000s bad.
Yeah, before they had discovered the science to let them pitch in Coors Field. Yeah,
before they made it a big cigar store.
Well, the relievers were not better, and were, as you've guessed by now, even worse actually. And when you're already down 12-0 after 3 innings, as they were on September 6th, 1930, even in 1930, they're going to send in somebody from the bullpen to just eat shit for a couple innings, which, nice. Again, as we repeatedly talk about in this podcast, is just the biggest slap in the face. The further back in history you go, the more offensive it is as a starting pitcher to be replaced by any sort of relief pitcher.
Imagine how bad it is to be a relief pitcher.
Yeah, yeah. Wondering if you'll ever play baseball again, despite being on a professional baseball team.
Hey, can I share an update? This is a breaking news. My sister has texted me asking, and I believe this is a question you could answer, Justin. Who is Bryce Harper, and why are so many people happy he came to the Phillies?
Wow. See, that's an interesting multi-layered question, easily answered by downloading the podcast Hittin' Season, a member of the Good Fight podcast family, which you can subscribe, download, and rate today. If you're listening to this, you're definitely a fan of Hittin' Season. In fact, you may have already turned this podcast off and gone to go listen to Hittin' Season, which is where we talk about the more relevant Phillies issues of the day, like the signing of Bryce Harper. So if you want to go ahead and send your sister a link, tell her to tell them I sent her, even though it's a podcast and they will not be able to hear her. And also, I will be on that podcast. So tell her to tell me that I sent her.
Sure.
I'm not going to do that, Justin.
Instead of answering my sister's question, I'm just going to send her a link to Hittin' Season.
No, Justin, I communicate with my sister, so I don't communicate with podcast links like you do with your family. So on September 6, 1930, the Phillies did the unthinkable and brought a relief pitcher into the game to replace Les Sweetland because, again, after he allowed 12 runs in three innings, things really weren't going as well as they'd planned that day. And like I said, they brought in someone from the bullpen to just eat shit. And that shit eater on this day was named Hal Elliott. Are you familiar, Trev?
No, not even a little bit. Hal Elliott?
Nor should you be.
How many, Justin, indulge me, how many innings did he pitch in his career?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question, Trev, one that can be answered by someone who is looking at that information, which is to say, innings pitched, he pitched 322 and a third, which
that's
is a lot.
Good. Was he a reliever his whole career?
He made scattered starts throughout four seasons from 1929 to 1932 with the Phillies. He actually led the league in games that he would appear in with 48 in 1930. Actually, Elliott took over this game for the Phillies after, like I said, Sweetland had made such a mess of things against the Brooklyn Robins pretty quickly. Elliott was 30 years old, having not broken through into Major League Baseball until he was 29 years old. And in 4 years with the Phillies, like I said, from 1929 to 32, his only 4 years in the bigs, Elliott would amass a 6.95 ERA through those 322 and a third innings. He never had a good year, but he did have 4 years.
I love he never had a good year.
Like, he just didn't. You know, even somebody trying to salvage some success from this guy's baseball reference page, you're just not going to find it, at least not the modern version of pitching success. There's a chance his 5.77 ERA in 1932 after appearing in 16 games was something to, like,
please,
you know,
do not pretend to tell me that that ERA was somehow normal in 1930.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I figured in 1930, they're like, all right, you're starting today, Elliott. And he would go out there and they'd be like, well, he allowed a run. I guess we got to shoot him. And like, that's how that went back then.
That has to be how it went. They don't let, they shoot pitchers, don't they? It's like, that's like.
I think there's got to be an old baseball book with that as the title. Yeah. Well, Elliott was born in Mount Clemens, Michigan. He served as a member of a certain squad in World War I, and I was about to say what it was, but I actually want to get your take on this, Trev. If you were going into let's say it's World War I. That's the technology available to you at the time. You're going into World War I, and someone's like, "All right,
the technology available to me at the time is it's World War I."
Yeah, I mean that's the era that the bounty of technology available to you.
I really love time. Like, all right, the technology is not so great. We're left with it's World War I. Like, wow, that is a bad.
Well, let me rephrase. Let's say your grandfather is spinning tales of his wartime self, and okay. And he's saying, "Oh, I was a part of the old badass blah 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 squad." What is the vehicle that fills in that blank?
Panzer Division.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm thinking like fighter jet. You know?
Oh yeah,
sweet.
Good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. Hal Elliott was a member of an observation balloon squad in World War I.
Listen, that's awesome too.
Their job was to float high up in the air in an oblong dirigible.
Did people even bother shooting that down?
That was my first and only thought reading about this. And apparently it didn't happen. Well, actually, let's read on. because it did happen. I was going to say it didn't happen often enough that they didn't immediately follow up. Oh, he's a member of a balloon squad. This was, of course, a terrible idea and extremely short-lived once they realized that bullets could pop balloons, but no.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's ridiculous, but also you probably don't want the enemy looking at your troops and, like, your positions and all, so, you know, just shoot a little mortar up there or something and pop. I mean, in World War I terms, this is the biggest gimme you're going to get.
Yeah, and it was, and they did know that. And especially since they knew, like, seeing a balloon meant, oh, okay, not only is that a delectable target, but at the same time, that guy is looking to get information on our position, so we got to take him out as fast as possible. And that would be a chore if it weren't for the giant balloon that he is attached to that is signaling exactly where he is and is deeply penetrable by bullets. Go ahead.
How did Hal Elliott survive?
Well, that's a terrific question, Trev. Being balloons, these were, like I said, particularly appealing targets to enemy fighter planes, which I assume could pop them with a casual strafing. But don't worry, it was 1930, and we had our best people on a contingency plan for Elliott and his fellow balloonists. In the event of an attack, the observer would simply jump out of the balloon, at which point a parachute deployed, allowing them safe passage back to the Earth.
And no one could hit a parachute.
No, I mean, what is a parachute if not part of a balloon?
I like the parachute option, too, because if you're observing over enemy territory, that just means that if you're... super obvious balloon gets shot down, you get to then be a prisoner of war.
Oh, yeah. Imagine you're just, like, up in the balloon. You hear the unmistakable hum of a fighter jet approaching, and your next plan, oh, no! I gotta get out of here! And you jump out, and the parachute deploys, and you're just slowly, ever so slowly, just sinking back to the ground.
I know where I'm spending the next 4 years.
Oh, those poor balloonists. These balloons were piloted, just to give you another idea of how menacing this job piloting these balloons was. They were piloted by emptying sandbags used as ballasts that weighed up to 100 pounds.
Classic.
That was to go up, and by expelling oxygen to move while they were up there. In World War I, the balloonists were often just tethered to the earth, rising only about 500 feet in the air, as free flight in a balloon piloted by, again, venting gas and dumping sand was not the most accurate mode of travel or attack. These were actually, they were used by the United States military as early as the Civil War, and instances of observers...
That makes sense to me. If it was the Civil War, you don't have as many options.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a balloon is the height, I feel, of technology during the Civil War. They're like, oh, my God. A Union scientist...
Doesn't deflate?
Oh, it's full of the devil's breath. We can't use this cursed object. Now back to having all the diseases.
What's so bad about that to me, like the tethered to the earth thing, is how easy it would be to be like, well, I found this balloon. It's the enemy. Maybe I'll just cut the string.
But it's moving so slowly. It would be more like,
guess I could just jump out and.
Don't worry, my foolproof plan of having a parachute is about to pay off.
Tragically, untethered parachuting was not actually supported at that time either.
Balloonists really led the war statistics in dead bodies floating slowly back to the ground.
It was a real meat grinder of a squad, but really too slow to be called a meat grinder.
More of a meat butter churn. Yeah, wow, this is our darkest episode yet.
Easily. If people are new to the show, that's saying something.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say about the balloons is that accidentally drifting into enemy territory was not uncommon and hadn't been since they were first used in the Civil War. So, you know, there were a lot of risks involved.
Yeah,
you might say Hal Elliott was a bit of a daredevil. I mean, maybe the balloonists really were the biggest badasses of the war. They had to just sit there, tell everybody where the other troops were, knowing full well they were easily spotted and destroyed. And their only mode of defense was not to fire a weapon back at their attackers, but to jump, presuming an automatically deploying parachute was going to automatically deploy at a time when automatic still meant maybe half the time it works.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy. And I mean, like, when the best case scenario is, you're stranded in enemy territory, that's pretty rough. Like, yeah. They write songs about guys like that. But usually it's not about balloons, so the songs are a little more, like, fun.
Not a lot rhymes with balloons, so they didn't get a lot of songs
kind,
in war days.
Kind of by design, I feel like.
So after the war, Elliott played for the Michigan Wolverines from 1921 to 22, then hit the minor league circuit with the Kalamazoo Celery Pickers, as well as a few other teams unworthy of mentioning after the Kalamazoo Celery
Pickers. I can't believe people don't wear that hat more often.
Seriously.
It's a classic.
He wound up getting drafted by the Cardinals in the fall of 1928 off a Waco roster in the Texas League, but St. Louis didn't keep him for long, and during 1929 spring training, they sent Elliott to the Phillies.
too bad, Cardinals.
A fate worse than dying in a balloon accident during the war.
Why couldn't I have just died of that cursed balloon?
So going to the Phillies would have been simple, if only how Elliott had known where to find them.
Oh, boy.
So this is from the April 1st, 1929 edition of the St. Louis Star and Times.
I'm excited to hear what happens here.
As the Cardinals answered roll call last night for their Pullman hop out of Tampa, pitcher Hal Elliott, traded to the Phils Saturday night, appeared on the scene and frantically stated his case. He didn't know where the Phils were to be found, and as the Grapefruit League had no... I can't read this. There's a bit of an obscured passage here. The men of Schaden... The men of Schaden, which is referencing the Phillies, because that's the last name of their manager at the time, could not be located in the cellar. After much dilly-dallying and telephoning the newspapers, the Philadelphia club was located, and Hal was given a one-way ticket for that destination. You'll notice they never actually even mention where they found the Phillies. I guess they were just traveling around the Grapefruit League like normal. He just didn't happen to know where they were that particular day and didn't know how to get to them.
I really like how Elliott pleaded his case. Like, please don't send me to baseball's negative zone.
Oh, all these players and coaches who until like an hour ago were his teammates and coaches. And he's just like pounding on the locker room door, be like, please let me in. Like wearing a barrel, just like, let me in. I just need to know where to go. And they're like, I can't help you. Not a Cardinals player anymore. Get out of here.
Sorry, my friend. You've been traded to the Twilight Zone.
Well, finding his way to the Phillies, things got no less complicated for Elliott that spring while he was in a car driven by the Phillies' Tom Thevenot late at night, just 2 days after joining the
Phillies.
Very
upsetting for him. It was too close to the earth.
Well, he was about to get even more upsettingly close to the earth.
Oh, boy.
They were jetting off to Lakeland to see some pals when Thevenot, who was driving, misjudged the speed at which an approaching car was traveling,
classic,
according to the
move.
Newspaper, and failed to get entirely out of the way. I do think he was drunk, yes. His front left wheel striking the rear left wheel of the oncoming car. Their car came to rest upside down. Elliott had to get 10 stitches in his face, and Thevenot wound up with a broken nose and jaw and was kept in the hospital for an operation. He wound up playing in 90 games that year still, after all that.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The
next season, the same guy, Tommy Thevenot, would lead the league in playing time, showing up in 156 games.
Honestly, not surprising if he played that many games with, like, an operation at the beginning of the offseason.
Yeah,
usually an operation keeps you out until August.
But, I mean, a car accident in 1929... Those cars were made out of like aluminum foil.
Yeah,
he wound up upside down. Like
the safety features were like, well, it doesn't explode instantly when it hits another car.
Well, we built it and it hasn't exploded yet, so let's sell it to somebody. Well, Elliott showed up in 40 games for the Phillies that year.
Had to wear helmets while you drove cars in the past.
I think Elliott should have been just wearing a helmet at all times after piloting a balloon during a war and surviving an upside-down car accident.
I really feel bad for him. I mean, like, this is like, he's dangerous at all speeds, basically.
Yeah, and things were not going to go great for him on the baseball diamond, as we learned as well. So where is the payoff for Hal Elliott? We still don't know.
Maybe he had a nice family.
We can only hope so.
Well, no, so, turns out his family was taken away by balloon thieves.
Turns out, yeah, balloon pirates sailed slowly away with his only living family member.
Come back.
We can't. They're dumping sand too voraciously.
Unfortunately, Hal Elliott didn't have a single rock or
to throw at them. Well, he tried, but he was just too inaccurate of a pitcher to hit them with a rock. Ah, pitching, my one weakness.
How'd they know?
Well, Elliott showed up in 40 games for the Phillies that year. He started 8 of them. He finished 13 of them. And in between, he gave up almost twice as many earned runs as he had appearances. 77 in 40 games. Nevertheless, he came back. Yes, yeah, you know it's not. He came back to the Phillies in 1930 and proceeded to get even more work while putting up even worse numbers, matching a league high in games with 48 and watching that ERA stabilize in the high sixes, low sevens until getting absolutely annihilated in September and ballooning into a nice, smooth 805.
Nice, nicely done. What a dream it must be to be a pitcher, a relief pitcher, and find a bad team in this era. Like, I know relief pitchers in today's game are like, well, you know, I don't want to be the closer on a bad team necessarily. Or like, you know, oh, I get to work up my stats at such and such. Like, you're only playing to get traded and you're fine to being in the seventh inning then, or whatever, right? Like, you, especially in the offseason, you pick your spots because you want to win a championship. Especially if you're volatile like a reliever is, maybe you won't get another shot. And in this case, you just basically, like, you're thinking that same thing, but you're like, well, I need to find a team that is so bad that I can pitch at least, like, 20 games. Like, they have to be so bad that their starters can't finish 20 games.
I don't want to have to look the starting pitchers in the eye because I know how shameful it is of them that I would be on the team with the intention of being in as many games as possible because it would mean that they are humiliations to their friends and family. So, yeah, I imagine that was a difficult feat at the time, to find a team where you could, as a relief pitcher, get a bunch of playing time.
I expect, yeah. I mean, like, it must have been just exciting for Collins to find a home.
Well, it was Hal Elliott, not Phil Collins, as badly as you wanted it to be. But he was always good to give up 5 to 7 runs, it seems. And at one time, he gave up 10 in 3 2/3 innings pitched.
Classic and, Phil Collins.
And they almost all happened in the bottom of the 5th inning against the Brooklyn Robins on September 6th, 1930. And we'll hear all about it when we come back. Brooklyn, 1930.
Wait, can we talk about those great ads we just heard from our sponsors?
It was a period of great growth as immigrants filled the tenements of Williamsburg. Lithuanian, Polish, Italian, Russian, and hipster. Jewish people. All hipsters arriving by the boatload. They had all arrived from Europe, and they'd begun settling there. In one block, you could find 5,000 people packed in like sardines. Sardines, of course, were an American tradition at the time, with John Steinbeck's novel Cannery Row being set in 1929. That industry would undergo another American tradition, imploding, and do so by the 1950s.
Hey, Justin.
Yes.
5 people to a tenement. What's different now? Yeah, because New York, it's hard to find living space there.
I feel like you threw the pieces at me before you'd assembled the joke. And,
what's different about New York now, Justin?
I got to tell you, I don't think we're going to edit this out or go back and give you another shot at it.
Answer my question.
So in 1930, in the decade ahead, Brooklyn would see the birth of Sandy Koufax, Woody Allen, Elliot Gould, and Louis Gossett Jr. But the Great Depression was in full swing at this point. But that didn't stop the music, Trev. In fact, the song titles were even longer back then. Apparently, couldn't publish a song without it being titled with a full sentence.
I love your. I love how you find the songs of the era every time.
Big hits like "Under the Sun, It's Anyone; Under the Moon, It's You," which is that's pretty poetic. That's I like sweet. That. Mm-hmm. That means somebody's like somebody hooking up you. With people all day and then coming home to you at night.
It's like if. Has no standards or discrimination during the day, but at night, it had to be you.
It's pretty much the plot of every Mad Men episode, yeah. Another one called All Through the Night Swinging on a Hammock. and Little White Lies, and Gee, But I'd Like to Make You Happy. Just a
seems
a couple
like there's
of real,
a bit of a complication there.
real bangers. Yeah, really.
Little White Lies. I'd sure like to make you happy. I'm getting some mixed messages in these songs.
You know, you'd have to work pretty hard not to get hit by a trolley back then in 1930 Brooklyn, Trev.
Is that right?
1,800 trolleys were working to all ends of the city. Their nemesis, cars, hadn't arrived yet. So this was public transit in its heyday. According
it's
to six
extraordinarily brief American heyday.
According to Six Square Feet, a New York State real estate, a New York City real estate and architecture news outlet, quote, to elbow streetcar franchises out, they joined forces and used murder, bribery, and blackmail to push their agenda through. And according to the Brooklyn Historic Railway Association, their very first victim was Manhattan's New York Railways, the operator of that borough's profitable electric streetcar system. In a pattern to be repeated all around the U.S., NCL gained control of the streetcar franchise by bribing elected officials and immediately ripped out the tracks, wires, and streetcars, replacing them with GM buses, burning Standard Oil gasoline, and rolling on Firestone tires.
Okay, everyone's a socialist these days, so what's your problem with competition?
I just thought it was interesting that this quintessential bit of Americana, especially in Brooklyn, was so gleefully ripped out of the city by conniving capitalists not too long after its heyday.
It's important that they did that, because how else would we have a terrible, terrible, cramped area to drive in like Brooklyn and Manhattan without that?
Well, speaking of self-indulgent people, no, that's not fair. That's not exactly what happened here. The Brooklyn Robins, who were playing in Brooklyn at the time, they're just another version of the Dodgers, who were called the Robins from early 1900s.
Version of the Dodgers is also the subtitle to this podcast.
They were named after Wilbert Robinson, or as he was called, Uncle Robbie, their beloved manager, who would manage Brooklyn from 1914 to 1931. He had fake teeth, a scar on his face, and was described as, quote, rotund and avuncular, back when people still used cool words.
Do you know what avuncular means, Justin?
Go ahead and tell us, Trev.
Oh, do you know?
No,
it's okay
I don't.
If not. It means of or like an uncle. I'm not actually joking.
Yeah.
That is what that
means.
That
makes sense, yeah.
Which is a great word.
According to Babe Herman in The Glory of Their Times, Uncle Robbie liked to reminisce on the bench and talk about the good old days and about fishing and hunting. In the off-season, he used to go to Dover Hall, a fishing and hunting place near Brunswick, Georgia, and sometimes he'd get so involved talking about the old Baltimore Orioles or about Dover Hall that he'd forget all about the ballgame and forget to give his signs to the third base coach.
That's awesome.
This was actually not as big of a disaster as you'd think, however, as Uncle Robbie had hired his Orioles buddy Joe Kelly to coach third base.
Wow.
And as Babe Herman found out during a live play one time, Kelly's vision was so bad he, quote, couldn't even see who was pitching, let alone what was being signaled to him.
Goodness gracious. That's not great.
Oh, you think that's not great? When asked why he wouldn't wear glasses, Joe Kelly simply said, pride. Trev, you're a glasses wearer, aren't you?
At least he didn't make a slur or something. I don't really see it as a point of a lack of pride to wear glasses. It seems fine, but I guess back in those days, it meant that you were destined to like be a balloon pilot or something, so
yeah, I can, proud of yourself, Trev?
No. Yeah.
Almost never. No, thanks for asking.
If you've listened to this podcast before, you know the answer to that is a solid no.
Well, at different points throughout their history, the Dodgers were called the Bridegrooms, the Superbas,
yes, the Brooklyn Bridegrooms,
the Ward's Wonders, but they were actually called the Brooklyn Baseball Club. That was their official name at this time.
All these names,
including the Robins, were not considered official, though they do appear to be called them in an official capacity by outlets like Baseball Reference.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess it also makes sense because their logo would shift throughout the time. I mean, if that's what people were calling them, then, you know, your official name, yeah, it is what like the paperwork says, but your like official name, your familiar name is going to be the one people actually remember. So there's a reason nobody knows that they were called the Brooklyn, or nobody talks about how they were called the Brooklyn Baseball Club. And in that name, baseball is separated into two words. So it's jeez, super wrong.
It's like a lame, it's like a painfully unaware mom or something talking about baseball.
Oh, you down at the Brooklyn Baseball Club? Oh, have fun today, Mom, with your friends. Well, this was a confusing time for people trying to read about their ball club in Brooklyn, as you might guess, because sports writers
no one could read.
Sports writers seemed to call the team whatever name would fit in the column they were trying to fill.
Right.
So in one instance, a newspaper called them the Robins, then the Superbas, then the Flock, as a reference to the Robin's name, which, as I learned researching this episode, any team that was named after a bird would be just called in passing the Flock.
I like
and
it.
you just kind of have to be aware of that as you're reading about them. So September 6th, 1930 was the Phillies' final appearance in Brooklyn for the season, and they looked just about done. The Inquirer called the Phillies, quote, battered athletes, and said this game allowed them to, quote, reach new heights in displaying their ability to take punishment.
Athletes is kind.
Yeah, I mean, it was very, very kind. I mean, again, there were some really good baseball players, baseball hitters, on this team.
Thank you.
And some marginally skilled balloon pilots on this team. But as we're about to find out, you know, Hal Elliott wasn't exactly skilled isn't probably the word you would use to describe him as a major league pitcher.
I'm glad that you said that he was a marginally skilled. Well, I feel like we should probably apologize to Hal Elliott for maligning his balloon flying, because he did survive.
I was going to say, if he was that bad, we wouldn't be talking about him playing in a baseball game years after the war.
I feel like that makes you, like, the top 3% of balloon pilots if you survive.
I think he might have been the ultimate badass, frankly.
It is kind of cool. If there wasn't much, much, much cooler things to make movies about, you could see, like, a Sylvester Stallone balloon pilot.
Yeah, before they had, like, shaken out what exactly would be cool, they were like, I don't know, maybe it's balloons. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Like early Hollywood, just like, okay, well, we'll call this one The Balloon Pilot.
I bet there's a movie called The Balloon Pilot. Like, let's be honest.
There are a lot of movies. I think you get the law of large numbers on your side here.
So the Phillies actually led in this game, scoring 4 runs in the second inning
always,
to overtake.
Always the worst feeling. I think.
Yeah.
When you lose like a laugher, but you led at one point.
That's what's crazy. When you learn the final score of this game, that the Phillies actually led 4-3 after the Robins 3-run rally in the first inning. It is pretty crazy. But Brooklyn answered with 6 more in the bottom of the second. This is another thing to take note of. We're doing a dirty inning episode on this game. We pick one inning, obviously, to focus on. We're not focusing on a 6-run inning.
Oh,
so that's telling you how much worse things are going to get.
Yeah, wow.
So
this is going to be a rough one.
The Robins led 12-5 when the bottom of the fifth came around, and absolutely no Phillies pitchers were up to the task of handling the Robins' offense.
How close to the last game of the season are we?
I want to say pretty close, but it's also, I think a couple of weeks. I think they finished the season up September, I want to say like 28th at this point. September. Yeah, September 28th. Sunday, September 28th, they played their last game against the New York Giants. They lost 7-6 and finished the season 52-102. Yeah. And just for the hell of it, since we're looking at it, in the month of September, they went 10-16, which is far from their worst monthly record.
I was
going to
say, that's not so bad based on what you're telling me about this team.
In May, they won 7 out of 22 games.
Yeah, that sounds
In July, right. July, they won 8 out of 33 games.
There it is. give me that depressing statistic.
Mm-hmm. So in the fifth inning, Les Sweetland was out of the game. And that pitcher who was asked to not handle the Robins offense was Hal Elliott.
Oof,
so,
boy.
Yeah, things are about to get a little prickly for our old buddy Hal.
I mean, so, he survived worse back in WW1.
That's true. That's probably what he was telling himself as the events of this inning took place.
I mean, hopefully he wasn't, because then he would know that there was going to be a World War II somehow.
something
would
like
be horrifying.
This inning gets to its worst point, and he just instinctively goes to pull the ripcord on a parachute, and then he remembers that he's not in a balloon. He's not in a balloon during a war. He's just pitching a really bad baseball game that feels like a balloon during a war.
It gets to its worst point, and then his eyes just go black, and he has a total premonition of what's going to happen in the next 40 years.
Those are the kind of innings we cover on this podcast. One so bad, you see the hellfire awaiting you in the future. Well, Eddie Moore led off for the Robins. He worked a walk to lead off. Later in this season, on September 27th, in the Robins' penultimate game, Eddie Moore would hit the last bounce home run in National League history.
Bounce home run.
Yeah, Trev, this was, of course, what they called a ball that bounced over the fence before the invention of the ground rule double.
Oh, interesting. Which,
yeah, it was less of an invention and more of a decision that it's just not going to be a home run if it has to struggle that much to get over the fence.
I think that's fair. I don't think you can't award the ballpark like giving you a bounce to give you a home run. Unless it's right. Like, I mean, it needs to be a lot more exceptional than that, I think.
I mean, we reward players for gravity continuing to function in baseball.
Yeah.
Essentially on every play. And that just seems like a very direct occurrence of that.
It's just excessive, you know, so. I think. Like where mm-hmm. where you're like, okay, look, you know, yeah, if the ball bounces off the top of the wall and it's kind of like cool, like, you know, oh, cool, it just got over or whatever. Fine, I can see that being a home run, or, you know, okay, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We'll confer with the refs. But if it's like, okay, it bounced on the turf and now it's in the stands, that doesn't count. Make that something else. Good hit. That doesn't count.
Right. And that's what they decided on December 12th, 1930.
Good.
That just wasn't going to be the case anymore. But this wasn't the only moment of Moore's career in which fate seemed to step in, actually. 6 years earlier, in 1924, you remember our Thanksgiving Patreon episode called Turkey, Stuffy, and Pie, in which we talked about two players named Turkey, a player named Stuffy.
Do I remember the Turkey and Stuffy episode?
And folks, if you want more bonus content from the Dirty Inning on our Patreon, just $5, you get plenty of Dirty Inning bonus content that it relates back to our most recent episode, as well as plenty of other wonderful, wonderful topics like myself and Liz Rocher reviewing trashy, sexy baseball romance novels, or John Stolness doing productive things like power rankings or This Week in Phillies History.
I would say the Thanksgiving episode was productive. We learned about someone named Turkey.
Exactly. And someone named Pie Trainer, who's a very famous baseball player.
We didn't really know about him, though.
We did not, but Eddie Moore knew about him because he almost stole Pie Trainer's job with the Pirates.
Oh.
Back when Pie Trainer was really hitting the skids, he was hitting .239 with a .622 OPS in 1924 and got his ass benched. Moore was the next man in, and he hit .423 after being given the opportunity. So things were going. It seemed like the beginning of a great story.
Yeah, Pie Trainer must have hated that guy.
He absolutely must have. And this seemed like another, you know, hey, maybe this is the start of a Hall of Fame career that fate helped kickstart. But wouldn't you know it, Eddie Moore got his shoulder dislocated by a pitch, which let Pie Trainer back in to take his job back, which he did, and resurged, finishing the year hitting .294. Moore also had a habit of smiling when he was uncomfortable, so still with the Pirates 2 years later, he was getting booed after committing an error and grinned in response. So the assistant manager and head of scouting for the Pirates saw him. They got in a screaming match in the dugout, and Moore was fined for indifferent play before being traded out of town. Can you imagine if that was still something you could... I mean, you can still fine a player for that, but just like that calling it that... I mean, you can fine a player for whatever you want, can't you?
I guess that's
true,
yeah.
You know, I feel like there's been players on the Phillies who are like, you know, dogging it up the line, and like as a show of authority, the manager has been like $1,000 or something. You know,
it's good that people can't do that in real life.
Yeah. So, man,
You know what? Someone did get fined. That it's his name's Manny Machado, and he got fined probably $200 million for not dogging it.
Yeah, he got fined to death, to the delight of all the Philadelphia baseball tough guys out there.
That's
right. Who never dog it when they're walking down the street at all. They just run in a dead full sprint from one place to another.
When my boss tells me to get something done, I run so fast.
Oh, yeah. I've seriously hurt myself running as fast as possible in very, very small spaces. It's extremely upsetting to everyone involved.
Just to get this piece of copywriting done. You got it, boss.
You got it, boss. Stop!
I'm out for the season.
Well, Babe Herman was up next, but he flew out. So that brought up Glenn Wright, who singled Eddie Moore over to third base, creating a threatening situation that was pretty much assured to blow the game open. Del Bizinet came up next. It was a wacky year on the base paths for Bizinet, whose name might be pronounced Bizinetti. I have no idea. It's long and full of letters.
Seems impossible to know.
Actually, this is such a bizarre thing. It was a wacky year on the base paths for Bizinet and Glenn Wright, mostly due to Babe Herman. Earlier in the 1930 season, on Memorial Day, the Robins were playing the Phillies again, and Bizinet was facing Phillies pitcher Claude Willoughby. He hit a deep fly ball, but Herman stopped between first and second, and Bizinet ran right past him and was called out. So, because the ball was so deep, but Herman wasn't sure if it was going to get over the fence, and the guy behind him ran right past him, so he was naturally called out.
Classic problem. Yeah.
Tomfoolery on the base paths, not unheard of. Something that's a finable offense to me, but you know that's not unheard of. But later in September, after the game we're talking about on September 6th, it was Herman again who hit the brakes on another deep fly ball, this one hit by Glenn Wright. Wright again passed Herman on the base paths, who again was being super, super cautious about this fly ball being caught. And in this case, it actually was a home run. Well, no, it wasn't a home run. It was a home run, but it was a bounce home run.
No.
Which is such a bizarre combination of all of these guys' stories. It was a bounce home run. It got over the fence. But because Wright had passed Herman on the base paths, they were only able to score two runs on a three-run home run. He was called out on a home run that he had hit.
How mad would you be at that player?
Like, furious.
I just so mad. Just don't worry about it. Just go fast.
Inconsolably furious. Seriously, dude. Come on. So
we lost here, by Herman, one run.
Sorry. Here, Herman was safely on the bench. He managed not to screw anything up for anybody, and Bizinet singled in Moore for the inning's first run. So, don't worry, it's going to get a lot worse. Left fielder Rube Bresler came up to the plate. Bresler was 35, aging out of his career, but was still as big a hard ass as ever.
Good.
In the previous season, a pitcher had thrown up and in on him, sending him to the ground. He had stood back up and immediately sent a jack over the fence. Later, he said,
"Cool.
I wish every pitcher would throw at me."
And did they?
And you'll be surprised to learn, Trev, that no, not every pitcher threw at the same hitter. Historian Lee Allen once said of Bresler that he was completely devoted to the game in which he excelled. Bresler would eventually join a group of ex-ball players who worked to stir interest in the game among underprivileged youth.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they were like a special ops team.
They were spies. They would hear people like bad talking baseball and be like, "Hey, you bad talking baseball," and they'd drag them behind like a soda fountain and just beat the living hell out of them.
Cool.
Yeah. That's a different epilogue than a lot of players from this era that we've read who wind up getting like blood throat from working in a silver mine or exploding in front of their families for no reason.
It's actually a very modern epilogue where, like, it's like, oh, yeah, and he went on to become an ambassador of the game.
Yeah, like, no, it really is.
You usually hear that. It's usually, you're usually right. Like, it's usually, like, bloodthroat or, they died in a war.
Right, he was in a balloon. He didn't get killed by the enemy, but we just, like, the tether came a little loose and we never saw him again after he sailed toward the horizon.
Wow, what happened to that colorful footnote in baseball? Well, he died of a heart attack at 52, leaving his widow and three children.
He died of wayward balloon syndrome.
Great.
Bresler lovingly walked to load the bases and make things much worse for Hal Elliott, and we'll hear how much worse right after this. Wally Gilbert was playing third base for the Brooklyn Robins that day, a rare time when he wasn't playing other professional sports, which he did, playing in the NFL for the Duluth Eskimos, you remember them, and the traveling Two Harbors All-Stars basketball team. He was quiet, he was dependable, and he put up some of the best numbers of his career in 1930. Some of them happened right now, Trev, when he hit a bases-clearing single thanks to a throwing error by Phillies center fielder Fred Brickle. Yeah. Cool. not a whole lot of those.
I like that. I mean, I don't think you would be like, I don't think you can say, you call your team the Eskimos no matter what, but like, you probably shouldn't call your team the Eskimos unless, like, you shouldn't even think about it unless you are in a place where there are Eskimos. And I feel like Duluth is like the last place I would expect Eskimos to be.
Yeah, well, this is embarrassing to ask, but what state is that? Is that Idaho?
I think that's Idaho. I don't know. Minnesota?
Wow. Can you imagine Idaho having an NFL franchise?
No. That's wild. I can't. I mean, I can't imagine Duluth having a professional sports team that isn't like a minor league. You know, like where it's like, oh, the Duluth, like, cinnamon buns. And you're like, okay, cool. I can see some prospects on this team.
Well, don't worry, Trev. There's just 5 batters left in this one.
Oh, excellent. What? How?
Al Lopez was watching the World Series in Cuba in 1920.
Cool.
Between the Robins and the Cleveland Indians.
Whoa, that's unaware an awesome that he, World Series.
Unaware that he would one day suit up for both teams playing in it. Coaxed into baseball by his older brother, Lopez quit high school and started catching for a local team.
Good.
And proved to be proficient as a backstop to the point that Walter Johnson, on a barstorming tour with the Senators, picked him up as a bullpen catcher at age 19. Lopez was parked next to Uncle Robbie in the dugout on September 6, 1930, as a member of the Robins, to develop his book on the league, because that's just typically the catcher was like the manager's protege.
Oh, I thought he was actually writing a book.
No. Just get a book on all the players that he would be, all the pitchers he would be catching, all the players he'd be playing against.
And that book, To Kill a Mockingbird.
So in doing so, he got to know his manager's mannerisms more so than any of the other players.
Good, because that guy probably like didn't. He had to know his mannerisms so that he could like say what had to happen if the guy got distracted and his blind bench coach couldn't see him.
Yeah, really. Yeah, like I'm sure we remember Uncle Robbie. You know, fake teeth, scar on his face, loved telling stories. So he described watching Robbie, who managed, apparently in a shirt and tie but with pinstriped uniform pants, place his tobacco on the bench, like one piece at a time, and just slowly work his way through his tobacco during an inning. So if it's a long inning, Uncle Robbie would chew the whole thing and then eventually spit the entire mess out into the water fountain. We wouldn't drink water for the rest of the day when that would happen, Lopez said. So Lopez, a defense first catcher, smacked an RBI ground out.
There are no non-defense first catchers in 1930, Justin.
That is a solid point.
Do not lie to the audience.
Well, he had an RBI ground out to give the Robins another run. But next up was Dolph Luque, who was also Cuban-born and considered baseball's first Hispanic star.
Oh.
Tragically, this was due to the lightness of his complexion, which to the racism surging through baseball's blood at the time made him, you know, more, quote, acceptable.
Excuse me, racism? So,
in baseball? I've never heard of it.
That's strange.
So, there's a tremendous legend about Luque's problem-solving skills I'd like to read now from Baseball with a Latin Beat, A History of the Latin American Game by Peter C. Bjarkman. Perhaps the most spurious of apocryphal tales in the ample catalog of legends.
I already hate this guy that he said this is spurious. I want it always to be like real.
I have so many more syllables to share with you.
Lovely.
The ample catalog of legends that often substitute for serious baseball history in the one surrounding the fiery-tempered Cuban hurler Adolfo Luque, who pitched a dozen seasons for the Roaring Twenties Cincinnati Reds. Legend has it that Luque, after a severe riding from the New York Giants bench, stopped in mid-windup, placed the ball and glove gingerly alongside the mound, then charged straight into the New York dugout to thrash flaky Giants outfielder Casey Stengel within an inch of his life.
Awesome.
So my first thought,
Casey
exactly.
Stengel.
My first thought was, yeah, exactly the same. It's just awesome. However, this story is decried by the author for its portrayal of Luque as a stereotype of a Latin hothead.
Well,
and
I guess.
As the author writes, that's true. But there are true components to the story. It occurred in Cincinnati's Redland Field, where the dugouts were closer to the pitcher's mound, allowing for Stengel's Giants racist commentary to more easily reach Luque's ears. But it was actually Bill Cunningham who Luque was aiming for, who had been shouting the most insults. But Cunningham,
the fashion guy from the New York Times.
I think I'm going to have to say that no, it's not the fashion guy from the New York Times that I'm talking about.
Good. He doesn't seem like a racist to me. So,
despite being totally caught off guard by this, Cunningham was actually able to dodge the blow that that Luque went to swing at him, and he dodged it, and Stengel was accidentally hit in the jaw. So the brouhaha continued after Luque was ejected, actually. And this is, again, from the book by Peter Bjarkman. The infamous attack, it turns out, was something of a humorous misadventure and more the stuff of comic relief than the product of sinister provocation, which I'm going to have to disagree with him on that. While the inevitable free-for-all that ensued quickly led to Dolph Luque's banishment from the field, the enraged Cuban soon returned to the battle scene, again screaming for Cunningham and brandishing an ash bat like an ancient war club. It took four policemen and assorted teammates to escort Luque from the ballpark a second time. Thus, the colorful Cincinnati pitcher had managed to foreshadow Maracal and Gomez, later wielding Latin moundsmen, later club-wielding Latin moundsmen, that's not a humorous misadventure. That's the same instance he said before, that it was like, yeah, he did this because he was provoked by racist other players.
Yeah, I feel like and racism also isn't in doing like so. Funny.
Yeah, and in doing so, he's right that I don't blame Luque for having an angry reaction to that, but you know there's no good thing for him to do in that situation because, yeah, he either has to sit there and take this racist commentary or feed into an unfair stereotype.
Now, the extremely cool part of that, though, is how Luque just calmly puts down his glove and then goes and attacks. Like, that's awesome.
That's the coolest part. Extremely badass and cool.
It's like, yes. It's not even the angry part. It's that he would just be like, what did you say? Mm-hmm. It's like, calmly, I'm going to put this down. I don't want to get my glove wet. Like, this is important to me, and I'm going to give your ass.
And then he goes in a dead sprint straight into the dugout.
It's so good. I mean, it's like
terrifying.
It's like Nolan Ryan, Robin Ventura. It's awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Luque singled here, followed by Elliott, who was still in the game, walking Johnny Frederick. And the final two batters of the inning contributed the worst blows, even though, yes, it was already 17-5.
Yeah, there's no worst blows. I feel like the worst blows have already... I feel like we're being rude to the poor pitcher, too, because, like, you know, it's not like Ellis did all the damage. he inherited a bad time.
I'm just hearkening back to our initial conversation that a baseball game becomes so bad it transcends baseball when you hit the 20 run mark. And in that regard, the worst blows are yet to come because Eddie Moore came back around because the Robins batted around and he knocked in a run. And then Babe Herman came up and you're not going to believe this, committed a base running gaffe that ended the inning. He tripled in two more runs and trying his luck. And I mean,
stupid idiot.
Really, really trying it, giving his history. Herman tried to score, which was ballsy, given that it was not a crucial run by any means. As we talked about, that's a weird time to try and stretch a triple into an inside the park
home
run.
My thinking is he did this because he was just sick of the game.
Like, yeah, I think he was like, I wonder if I can do it.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, who cares?
But with the Robins ahead by 15 runs at this point, he was thrown out at the plate. Trev, the Robins went on to win this game.
Really?
22-8.
Now, wait. Can you explain what happened in the rest of the innings? just kidding.
Why bother? Well, Trev, we'll finish up this episode of the Dirty Inning, not just reflecting on all the mistakes we've made in our lives as this inning seems to drum them up in our minds, but also with the knowledge that there is, in fact, a soundtrack to a movie called Balloon Pilot that exists if you look up Balloon Pilot on the Internet Movie
Justin,
Database.
You did it. You did it.
It seems like it's a German movie. Like all the other weird
like
credits attached to
flicker.
This are all... They all have German names. I don't know. My guess is it's a short film, but it's really got very little details. Or maybe it's an artist's name. I think it might be an artist who appeared on a soundtrack. That's what it is. Named Balloon Pilot. All right. I think that's what we're talking about.
Wow.
But in any case, friends, we've lived, laughed, loved, learned about another inning of Phillies history in which the team utterly humiliated themselves. We've learned about some of the least threatening aircraft of the First World War.
And the brave boys who drove those death traps.
But of course, if you enjoyed this episode of the Dirty Inning, stay tuned. We do two monthly episodes of The Dirty Inning every Tuesdays, every other Tuesday. And of course, this is part of the Good Fight podcast family. And so if you enjoy this, you will certainly enjoy the other members of our family, which include Hit and Season with John Stolness, which is a review of all current Phillies activities, as well as interviews with Phillies insiders and other baseball writers and personalities, as well as Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, which is a rawer commentary on Phillies baseball. But at the same time, we are going to begin what we did last year. Last year, we reviewed the seasons of the 2008 and 1993 Phillies because of the respective anniversaries they had last year. So that means this year we're going to be reviewing the 2009 Phillies, who also went to the World Series. People forget that.
So that's going to start really soon. Why do people forget that? That was a really good team.
Yeah, and there's a lot of... Yeah, but there's a lot of cool moments that happened that season.
That was
Cliff Lee coming for the first time.
Come on.
The Cliff Lee no-look catch in the World Series. Pedro Martinez was on the Phillies. Exactly. So there's a lot of cool stuff we're going to talk about. So if you like the Phillies of the past, present, and future, you'll love the Good Fight podcast feed. Be sure to subscribe, download, and rate us at your earliest convenience.
And I mean, and Justin and I aren't even on every podcast. So, like, I mean, Justin's on most of them, but I'm not. So,
well, if you really like the Phillies, again, it only costs $5 to get bonus content on our Patreon. That's patreon.com/hittenseason. So thank you for listening to The Dirty Inning, and we will talk to you next time we find a terrible piece of baseball to talk about.
Oh, don't worry, it'll be soon.
This episode of The Dirty Inning contained information from the following sources. Brooklyn Dodgers in Cuba by Jim Feedy. Home Runs Most Wanted, the top 10 book of monumental dingers, prodigious swingers, and everything long ball by David Vincent. Al Lopez, The Life of Baseball's El Señor by Wes Singletary. Baseball with a Latin Beat, a history of the Latin American game by Peter C. Bjarkman. Pie Trainer, a baseball biography by James Fore and David Proctor. And Home Run, the definitive history of baseball's ultimate weapon by David Vincent.